Well, every so often we're graced with the opportunity to speak with people of fairly significant power and privilege within cricket. Today is one of those days. Typically, when you set interviews up like this, you make a calculation. You ask yourself, should I probably go to this person? Should we travel to them, or should we maybe meet in the middle? Or you know, are we pushing the barrel if we say, you know, let's get them to come to us? And today, it's very happy to say that, you know, the constitutionally most powerful person in Australian cricket, Mike Baird, joins us in studio on the dilapidated TGC studio couch for a chat about hopefully, you know, the state of the nation in Australian cricket and global cricket as well, and also your club cricket bona fides. But with that in mind, Mike Baird, welcome to the Grad Cricketer.
Well, it's an honour, and I don't think there's anyone in Australian cricket that wouldn't want to come to this bunker.
So no, there's heaps, actually.
Yeah. We've upset quite a few people over the time.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, it feels a privilege to be here, see what happens behind the scenes. Look forward to it.
What are your early impressions of what you've seen behind the scenes?
Well, I mean, it pretty much matches what you hear. Style, yeah. Sophistication.
Yeah, that's how most people would describe it.
A bit of humour around the place. So, no, very impressive.
You have club cricket bona fides. and, you know, a lot of serious administrators will want to be keen to get that out there just to, you know, to show the masses that they know the game. So for you, it's Camaray Cricket Club. I have to say, like, grade cricketers would look down on that level, possibly even, you know, do you use wheelie bins for stumps? Mm-hmm. But give us the elevator pitch of your club career.
You know, look, I loved cricket, and it was a big part of my life. You know, early on, I lived in America, so I played baseball, and so my batting kind of more resembled a baseball swing than a cricket swing. So I didn't have the traditional technique. I had a bit of hand-eye, and I had a decent arm, and so it came together in cricket. And I played, a range of places. I mean, I played at Kissing Point Cricket Club, part of the Hornsey-Ku'ring'ai Cricket Association. Played a couple of years there in the Durham Shield, the under-19s. Ended up at Camaray and also Epping Shires I played.
Oh, so you played Shires?
Yeah, okay. So not quite, great. Yeah. I know you look down on Shires.
Of course, yeah. A lot of good people there. But
the Shires, the Shires group kind of view themselves as great cricketers that don't have the time to do the training, I think.
Indeed. Some of them get paid as well, right? Maybe there's a bit of coin looking around.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. I've only ever heard of it too, but anyway.
There's a lot of pokies winnings, I think, yeah.
But it's your position on that?
It was let that go. So played many years, about 10 years, sort of post school, and many ups and downs, and sort of great moments and terrible moments. But big part of my life. I also spent a year in Canada. I studied at University of British Columbia, and I played for the Burrard Cricket Club for a year.
And Canada in cricket.
And it was amazing, actually. Yeah. It was, in fact, I played at Stanley Park, and at Stanley Park there's this beautiful clubhouse, and up there there's a letter from Don Bradman to the club saying that it was his most favourite cricket ground in the world, or picturesque, maybe the most picturesque, and it was, because it's looked out across Vancouver Harbour, and then there were snow-capped peeps, beautiful. So, that was probably my most successful year of cricket, you know. My mates back home were skeptical, but it was an incredible team. It was multicultural. I had a Moroccan wicketkeeper. We had a beautiful Indian batsman, number three, Ravi. Had Leela Hull from England that was an opening bowler with me. So there was and a West Indian captain, Big Dave. So that combination, that multicultural kind of connection, love of cricket, bringing it together was special. So it's been a big part of my life.
Are you playing a mashing in Canada, or are you playing a turf wickets?
No, Astro.
Astro.
Yeah,
okay.
It was Astro. So,
So Bradman's turned up to this ground, and he's seen Astro, and he said, "This is the most picturesque ground."
Well, I think from what I could see, he played on it. You know, so I think he played. I don't know the history of it, but no, he certainly played up there.
I'm going to research that.
Yeah, yeah.
Have a look. Bradman in Canada on an Astro deck.
Yeah, have a look.
I did like the
short
stuff.
I'm sure
he got runs. I'm sure he did.
So just for background for those who wouldn't know, perhaps listening overseas, I mean, you are the former Premier of New South Wales. That is some serious halls of power stuff. just for the uninitiated. And, you know, it's always fun to interrogate the relationship of politicians with sport. You know, some people have come a cropper, are trying to kind of connect themselves to sport or be involved in media ops involving sport, if you know what I mean. But I look at this, I'm going to show this picture in a second. I look at this this picture of you from a Good Weekend profile on you after assuming the CA chairship. And this is, we'll get it up on the YouTube as well, but
That's you there. You've seen this shit.
If you just listen to the pod, Mike Baird is, you are rocking back and like this is a photo shoot, like you would have been in a studio for this.
Yeah.
You are rocking back and crashing a ball just forward of point, hypothetically.
There's a lot of baseball.
With a suit on. I also know
past mid-wicket, I think, isn't it?
Oh, well, it's interesting. Oh, so you actually have quite an open stance then is what I'm saying. I mean, yes. For me, you've got a side-on stance. You're going forward of point, but you're saying you're sort of front-on here and you're hitting to the leg side. I mean, either way, you've taken the long handle as well. You're in a suit. Your eyes are narrowed. Is that, you know, the approach you're taking to the chairship at Cricket Australia as well?
No, I mean, I think... Well, I mean, I think if you're doing something, you know, do it well. Go all in. Mm. You know, don't back away from it. And no, I think the chairship is more. Yes, I mean, you're looking for all the opportunities. So it's not just a defensive game; it's offensive. And you know, I don't think cricket has faced anything like the opportunities at the moment. But before you grab those, you have to make sure that you know there's good relationships, good foundations, and everyone's kind of working as one. You know, so I think that's where we've done well in the past sort of 12 months in particular, where we've come together much more across the Australian cricket system and started to kind of work on these unbelievable opportunities that are before us. So, yeah, I mean, certainly I think it's unprecedented what faces us and, you know, whether it be an aggressive approach at the crease. I mean, certainly I think we have to on behalf of cricket. You know, we've got to look at what's coming and go after it.
We want to get into that in a serious way, but just before we do,
yeah.
Cricket and sledging, politics and sledging,
oh.
Some of the best sledging
hands
of
hand.
All time in politics, Question Time
yeah.
against your opposition. Like, are you willing, you know, at least out of politics right now, to call out, Who are the best sledgers other side of the aisle, you know? And moreover, there's a phenomenon in cricket of like someone being a good bloke once you get to know him. You know, tough to play against on the field, but good once you get to know him. So how are you as a sledger in politics?
Yeah.
When you're going hand to hand combat, verbal combat, and who are the best on the other side as well? Who are the best you've seen? Who you look up to from a sledging perspective?
Oh, well, the captain of that has to be Paul Keating.
Yeah.
He had a spectacular wit. I didn't see those heights in the chamber I was in.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone had a fair share. There was a general approach of, you know, if an opposition could make you look incompetent, you know, or corrupt, and ideally both, then they're having a great day, mm-hmm. you know. So... there's fun, but you also have to be prepared for battle because there's a contest of ideas and, you know, they're always looking for chinks in your armour. Mm. I always held it reasonably lightly and, you know, one particular Question Time I had fun where I sort of accused the opposition right before the election that, you know, they thought that they were going to win and they were going to roll over the top of us and... I said, not only are you not going to win seats, but we're coming for your seats. And anyway, it was somehow kind of went a bit viral. And because my troops, they were excited that Parliament was almost over, we're almost at the election, and they all jumped up and roared, and the opposition are there looking quite dumbstruck.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, out of a very limited pool of highlights, that was one. But, Yeah, no, I certainly tried in my time in politics not to play the person.
Mm.
And I think, you know, when I look at politics, that is what is a bit disillusioning to a lot of people. It's that personal partisan. And, you know, I certainly tried to go for policy and argue that. So, I mean, others can judge on that. But no, I don't think no one stood out in my parliament as a sledge. I mean, you know, Luke Foley was pretty good at it.
Mm.
But all, you know, my sense, there was a reasonably good spirit in the parliament.
I've got to tell you, it'd be one of the easiest jobs in the world, Mike, to try and prove that grey cricketers were corrupt. Anyone you played with, ethically, morally, financially, like
a constant theme. Well, the opposition had fun with that.
And those are just the guys you play with. The state of Australian cricket, Mike, obviously you're the big dog at CA. In the last 5 years, Australia have lost two test captains, one to cheating, one to sexting. There was an ethics review. Kerry Stokes wanted to take CA to court. Stuart McGill got kidnapped. But we won everything. So how's it going?
Look, I mean, I think, you know, like anything, there are highlights and lowlights. But I think success on the field is one thing. But I also think, you know, it's how you do it and who you are is just as important. And, you know, when I look at this team and I look at Pat Cummins' leadership, I think he is role modelling, you know, exactly what our young kids should be looking for in role models. I mean, I love the fact that he came back from India because his mum was dying. Mm. You know, think of captains of industry, think of political leaders, you know, think of, you know, sports leaders of national teams. Like that, the overwhelming sense would be you have a responsibility to keep going. You have an overwhelming sense, in my view, to be the best person you can. And being the best person should trump that. And going back to be with his mum was an incredibly powerful moment. You know, I hope every kid in Australia saw that. So it shows, yeah, that matters. Cricket matters. It matters a lot. And representing your country matters. But there comes times that other things do. And I think what he showed in that was the sort of role modelling you want. So, yeah, we've seen examples where there's been failure. You know, I also think, you know, all of those people that are critical, I mean, everyone fails. I mean, I fall short regularly. You know, we all have our shortcomings. So everyone should be afforded the chance to learn from those. Everyone should be afforded redemption. And, you know, I think we've seen that. And this team currently and the women's team, I mean, two incredible teams that I think are providing not only showing incredible success on the field, but also kind of role modelling to our generations, which is important because cricket, as you know, is much more than just a game. And it's a big part of Australia's DNA. So I think when cricket's going well and some of those role modelers are having an impact, I think it's having a big impact across the country.
Mm. I mean, just want to pick up on the Pat Cummins thing. I'm not sure where you arrived in this situation, but I believe that he and his team, not that he said this, they define themselves in many ways in opposition to those who came before. I mean, you talked about, you know, you put a lens over your political life as being more about policy than being about partisan sledging. You know, you could make an analogy between that and the way Australian cricket has been played in the past to the way it's being played now. You know, Pat Cummins is about he's about the team. He doesn't really talk about the opposition or to the opposition. The team doesn't really seem to do that, and it runs in opposition to the way a lot of our heroes played the game, a little bit more combative, a little bit more hostile. Does Cricket Australia give thought as to how it can continue to seed the Pat Cummins way of playing cricket across the nation? Because to me, it will only take a couple of losses before those old forces start to go, no, we need to get harder again. You know, we need to start playing the old Aussie way.
Yeah, and look, it's real. I mean, yeah, I mean, I grew up watching Alan Border, and I loved it. I mean, as a left-hander, I loved his batting.
Yeah.
Just, he was always so gritty and, you know, up for the fight and the battle. You know, similar to Steve Waugh. yeah, but it was also known as Captain Grumpy, and he was tough and relentless. And, you know, with the teams he had, he probably had to be. You know, it was a tough time for Australian cricket, and he achieved some remarkable results. But look, I don't necessarily think that you want to say this is exactly the way it should be. You know, I think there's, when you're looking at captaincy, there's a whole range of things that go into it, mm-hmm. you know, kind of values and approaches and understanding track record. I mean, there's a whole kind of matrix of consideration, which you should do for any leader in kind of any organisation. But no, this, to me, what we can't underestimate, what connects into kids and generations, inspires them to play, is that personal connection. And you can't sort of shape that or define that. You either have it or you don't. And I mean, every Australian captain will. But I think this is a very special period. You know, I look at Pat Cummins and I think that, you know, I've worked in all different spheres. I've seen all types of leaders in all types of circumstances. And he stands right at the top. And I don't think anyone would say that Pat Cummins isn't tough.
Mm-mm.
I think he's shown incredible toughness and sometimes under the greatest pressure, you know, both off the field and on the field.
Mm.
And, I think that we, in many respects, Australian cricket, underestimate the character he is, the significant leader he is, and what a wonderful opportunity he is for cricket.
The fixtures for the Australian summer came out yesterday. Mm-hmm. Yesterday. Yep. Today's Wednesday as we're recording this. Is it today, Wednesday?
Yeah, it's Wednesday today.
Wow, okay. and so India's obviously in the men. India coming out here, 5 test matches. First time in a long time it's been 5 test that series. Can you put in context the value of that, Mike? Like the value of that for Australian cricket, that India are out here for 5 test matches, and in the context of what would it mean if India stopped coming out here?
Well, I mean, it's the biggest cricket community in the world.
Yeah.
You know, so...
it's going to be awesome. Like the colour, the vibrancy, the energy. Great men's team as well the last couple of years, beating us out here, all that stuff. Yeah, I'm just talking about like, the actual value economically, I suppose.
Yeah. And financially it's significant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's undoubtedly the most significant tour.
Yeah.
And, you know, that plays out in different ways. I mean... the number of people that watch it sort of back in India, from state government's point of view, it's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, and we've kind of liaising with state governments.
Right.
Because many of the senior leaders across the world, Indian leaders, are coming, and companies are kind of taking advantage of that. So there's conferences, there's leadership gathering. I mean, it will be huge.
Mm. Is it bigger than the Ashes?
Yeah, in that sense.
Yeah.
I mean, Ashes is obviously huge as well. But this will be. And I think it's also a point in time. I mean, India have beaten us twice in a row at home. You've got this team, which is the World Test Championship, and, you know, arguably the most successful 12 months Australians team's almost been through in terms of the trophies and the various successes they've had. So you've got a combination, and you know what we saw in the Ashes last year was and the World Cup, you know, this heightened interest from the Australian cricket fan. So there's huge anticipation. The commercials are significant, you know, the bilateral opportunities between Australia and India and the business opportunities. You know, it's hard to imagine event, and you know, when you kind of think about other sports, you know, it's there's lot to like about other sports, but this is quite unique to cricket. And you know, this summer coming up, it is going to be, I think, one of the most anticipated summers we've ever had.
When Cricket Australia announces that Perth is the first test, to what extent is that driven by the fact that we'd like to go upstairs to the Indian bats and intimidate them with hostile bowling?
Well, there's a range a range of things that go into deciding it. But one thing is
getting it through the chest, basically.
To what extent is it wanting to get off to a good start on a pitch conducive to the way we play?
Well, look, I mean, I've seen India play very well on those wickets. So I think you know, what we want to do with the venues, and that there's the moving around, you know, to me is something that needs to stop. We need to kind of lock in so everyone knows, you know, what test, what effective time. I mean, it can shift a little bit depending on the sun. But, you know, that enables state governments to anchor it. It enables them to invest in it, to put promotion around it. It becomes part of their calendar. And fans as well. You know, where's it going to be? Like, you know, this time of year, that's where it's going to be. And, you know, so I think that surety. So, you know, Perth, I mean, it did well. I mean, there was a record sort of crowd versus Pakistan over in Perth. You know, it's coming back. I mean, obviously, they've had unbelievable Big Bash success. And you want to see that sort of continue with the Test cricket. And I think you'll see that. I think it'll be a cracking start to the summer.
Is Mr. Modi supposed to come out? I suppose he's got the general election this year. Is he going to come out?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't checked with him. Maybe I'll just well, I
haven't
check
texted
him.
But you met him 10 years ago now when you were premier.
Yeah, no,
he came to Sydney, right?
He did. I did. I engaged with him, and he wanted me to go back to his Gujarat conference. There's a big sort of business conference once a year, and so I went to that as New South Wales Premier. And no, I just saw him at the one day final.
Ah, right.
And I mean, I thought that
don't talk too much about that because we'll lose more subscribers.
Oh no, I'm sorry.
That's what happens. So keep it positive.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I enjoyed it.
wow.
But. And I saw him, and I didn't think he would remember from past on.
Yeah,
But he did.
So. Yeah, right.
Yeah, no. So look, he's obviously an impressive leader on the global stage,
right?
And you know, it would be fantastic if he came across. I mean, yeah. I think the event would be significant. I don't think you'd see a repeat of what happened with Almo.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
on the Batmobile.
Baird and Modi on the Batmobile the SCG.
No, well, I'm thinking, would you have the PM? And I don't. Yeah. I'm not sure whether Bay 13 would be cheering. Yeah. I mean, that's nothing personal against Almo. I just think that's the Australian way.
Yeah. I think.
Who would it take? Maybe a Dermot Brereton or something. anyway.
Well, maybe Dermot and Bob Hawke. Maybe that would be all right.
Bob Hawke would be hard. But I want to talk about India a little bit as it relates to your role. Like, starting with with our experience, like we're covering the IPL now, for example. It's the fourth year in a row we've done it. It's not unusual, and we enjoyed doing it and learning more about it. Not unusual for segments of our, let's call it Anglosphere audience, to suggest that we are doing it, you know, cynically and purely to kowtow to the Indian dollar. It's not our view, but that sentiment does exist. And I do note that it exists in Australia and England when it comes to all matters India quite a lot of the time when we're talking about cricket. I think a lot of us have been raised on the presumption that Australia and England somewhat steward the direction of the game when that's not really the case anymore. What do you observe to be India's vision for the game when you work with the BCCI or the powers that be? I'm sure it's difficult to generalise, but what is the vision for the game as you observe it?
Yeah, well, I mean, India's a big part, and I start with a fundamental premise, and that is I just love India. Like India is an incredible country, history, culture, vibrancy, ambition. You know, even Prime Minister Modi, I mean, he's had a vision to take hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Simple things like providing bank accounts to give people more opportunity, surety, a capacity to save and start moving ahead. Like I think the opportunities we have in trade, in investment, in partnership with India is incredible. You know, when I was in public life, there was regular visits because, I mean, it's a long-term sort of opportunity, but we have this deep connection between us, history. Cricket plays an essential role in that. So I start with sort of great admiration for India, huge opportunities and joint opportunities. And, yeah, I think we can become sort of focused. Well, there's, you know, a lot of money, a lot of the population kind of sits in India. So that kind of leads to this power imbalance. You know, I just think that you look at it another way. That what an incredible opportunity India is. You know, aren't we lucky in cricket to have that sort of population so passionate and fervent about a game we love? And so how do we work together? And I think if you do that way, you've got much more chance to kind of working in partnership. And that, for me, is genuine, and hopefully they will see it's real. So, yeah, and the same thing. I mean, yes, Australia needs to lead, as does England, as does India. I mean, as the collection, you people will talk about those three. But you can't forget the other member countries. You know, we're not just looking after ourselves. I mean, this is about growing the game for the long term and across the world. And there's over 100 associate member countries. The existing member countries, how do we include and bring them along? So, you know, I think, you know, that's the way we need to think. If we're going to maximise the opportunities that are before the game, I mean, look at the US sports market. I mean, the $250 billion is a conservative estimate of what it's worth. Now, it's not just about how do we get part of that and grab part of that revenue. In my mind, how do we access that, give opportunities to our players, young boys and girls, but how do we then bring that back and continue to grow cricket, you know, community cricket, grassroots cricket. So growing the game globally, accessing opportunities together, but making sure we never lose sight of growing our local game and community cricket, I think that's the way I would sort of march forward. So part of that is the relationship with India and trying to do things together, but in a way that's respectful and about that long-term aim of growing the game around the world.
Can I just say, just follow up on that? He goes, there will be a lot of people listening to this and watching this, I'd suggest particularly in Australia and England, but it could be further than that, who would note what you say about the passion of Indian fans and the potential of power imbalance. And if India exerts such a disproportionate amount of power on the game, which includes receiving a lot of the ICC disbursements, and people noting that the game seems to be trending towards more short form white ball T20 competitions, that there is a degradation of Test cricket seen in the lack of commercial viability for all nations barring three to play, that while there might be certain growth of the game in real terms, that growth and development is not matching the expectations or the desires of Australian and English fans, for example, who would like to see growth in Test cricket or red ball cricket. They see degradation of that stuff. So what do you say to those people who take that view, who might take that view that it's not all roses in cricket and that there's a lot of international teams that do seem to be in their own state of degradation, as well as the wealth concentrates on domestic franchise tournament as run by Indian franchise owners?
Yeah, and look, I would say they're not mutually exclusive. You know, I think they can operate together. And I think that as administrators, there is a responsibility to protect the essence of the game, the history of the game, and that's a legacy of any administrator. At the same time, you can't ignore the trends and the opportunities.
Yeah.
And, you know, the numbers tell an incredible story. I mean, Test cricket in the past few years has pretty much been stable in terms of viewership. T20 has been growing exponentially.
Yeah.
And one day internationals have been falling.
Yeah.
So you have three formats. Now, the ODIs, to me, what the research shows, two parts to it, and that was a lack of context to the matches, if you think about it, and many matches that are lopsided. So the more competitive it is, the more context it is, the more interest it is. And at T20, you have both of those, and it's a shorter format. Test cricket can have both, but I think the onus on us is to shore up, and you would have seen India announce sort of changes in their payments to tests.
You know,
and that's...
Having to play Ranji Trophy as well.
And we've kind of spoken about that, and, you know, they've kind of leapt on that and pursuing it, and we need to think about that more broadly across member countries. Now, not every associate member country is going to be able to play Test cricket, but, you know, those that are playing right now, we have to look to way to strengthen them and to maintain it. I mean, look at what a lot of the test players, well, they'll tell you that that is the format.
Mm-hmm.
For those that have grown up on it, like me, there is nothing better than minute one to last minute of a test match and the ups and downs and every life lesson that is shown and comes through that period. And it's shown it still does have a strong audience. So it's a matter of being creative in maintaining it. It's a matter of sort of also embracing some of those other opportunities. And, you know, T20 is incredible the way it's going. But, you know, we also do have to stand up. We can't be in a position that national cricket, international cricket, is not given primacy. You know, we have to make sure that is maintained, and we have to work with member countries to do that. We have to look at things like windows. We've got to give context to the contests. So all of those things can be done. I mean, it's tough because there's different priorities. But, you know, the right sort of leadership with the right sort of mindset across that group, you know, I think it can. And, you know, my interaction with the BCCI and, you know, Jay is obviously the secretary there has only been positive. And, you know, I do think that they do think very strongly about maintaining the game, and they've got an obligation responsibility with all that's come to them through cricket, you know, to make sure they play. I mean, they do regular tours. They make sure that they give back. So, yes, they can do more, but, you know, my sense is there's the right approach.
I think it's really difficult, I think, for – I'm going to say Australian specifically, and the reason I say is because, like, the IPL is awesome, and it's so difficult to watch in Australia just purely from a time zone sense, right? I never watched it until about 4 or 5 years ago, and then you watch and you go, oh, no, these are all the best players playing – in front of packed houses every night. The energy, the quality of the cricket is outstanding. The grounds are the right size, so there's the right number of sixes and fours and close finishes. And but I think the pinnacle of the sport in Australia is the Ashes, and that's a test series. And the reason I say that is the pinnacle is because I don't think yet that we can replicate the feeling of what the Ashes means to a fan. You know, like, we just feel it so culturally because we've got friends and ancestry in the UK and vice versa to them. We hate them, they hate us, but we all love each other at the same time. And the legacy and the history of test matches is so important to us. It's really important to people of our demographic, of our generations. We can pair us all together. I think young people, though, probably like short form cricket because of TikTok brain, where you need you know, sugar hits all the time. So then I couple that with the IPL rights being sold for $6 billion 2 years ago, whatever. You've got Avram Glazer of the Glazer family owned United, part of that, trying to get the sport into the US. You've got Mukesh Ambani, one of the richest men in the world, pushing it in a certain direction as well. And so we're trying to, it feels like we're trying to get a foot in both camp, where, like, we've got to keep our test matches going because that is really important to us. And also the money that we get from the Border Gavaskar Trophy, right? And then we've also got the Big Bash. Now, what I can't get my head around with the Big Bash is that this year now, this summer coming up, will be the second year of three summers where there's no nationally contracted players playing in the Big Bash. I can't think of another country that doesn't have their best players playing in their domestic T20 competition. So I guess I'm trying to ask is why? Why is that? Because we're trying to play our Big Bash and our test matches on at the same time, and there's just not that many well-known, recognisable players for everyone to share.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
No, it's fair. And I think that you know, the fans have asked for that and are responding to that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think there's been a real effort in the, like, last season to do that, you know, to make available, you know, the best possible players. And actually in the next 2 years, they will be available, you know, obviously not for the full competition, right, but there will be kind of opportunities post the series. So look, yeah, I mean, we have to think about it and respond to it. You know, there's no doubt, because I'm strongly of the view you've got to have the best product. I mean, this is a competition, entertainment across all types of different varieties, and if you're not putting your best product there, that's going to have an impact. I mean, you know, we love, you know, watching our teams play, and there's lots of little fans, but, you know, having, you know, as many Australian players as possible at least available for part of the season, I mean, think has to be a key driver, you know, for all the reasons that you articulated. Mm. So that is something that we need to spend more time on. But the next couple of years, I think, you know, the fans will have both. You know, they'll have these incredible series. And I agree with you. I mean, the Ashes, with all of the history, you just can't top of it. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it goes all the way back to convict days, probably. We have this DNA about us that beating, you know, our English friends is hard to beat in terms of a pinnacle. But, you know, I think that the Indian rivalry and competition is building and building.
Yeah, definitely.
Know, as it has to start as somewhere.
Is the history. Yeah. Oh, absolutely, I just think about, like, the Big Bash, like, how good that competition could be if it was, let's say, it went for 7-8 weeks and you've got Cummins, Smith, Stark, Head, Marsh, you know, all the guys playing, and then it's all of a sudden every night there's a guys that I want to watch play cricket, you know. I find this is just anecdotal because it's just me, but I find it difficult to watch a full day of test cricket and then also see the games on at night against I feel like I'm watching the Marsh Cup. I feel, you know, with respect to you know, the very good state players who I've just disrespected. but do you know what I mean? I look at the Big Bash and it could be so good if our best players were playing in it, but they can't do both.
Yeah, and they can't do both, but that's, yeah, we do have to think about that longer term.
Right.
But I am, like, the next two summers, there will be lots that'll be playing. You saw that recently. You know, Steve Smith came back and, you know, those centuries and, you know, the crowds going crazy. I mean, they'd love to see it, like we all would.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we definitely have to wrestle with that.
Can I try and, like, tie that together a little bit? The reason why we're talking about domestic franchise cricket and the reason it's important is we're looking at the IPL. We can see the trends, $6 billion. Every country needs a really strong asset as its domestic franchise tournament. I want to ask you about private equity in a second. I know you got Morgan Stanley last year to have a look at stuff and whatever. And so that's probably partly why we're talking about, you know, the question of why Australia cannot have its best players play in its domestic franchise tournament. Until it does, it's always going to be second, third, fourth, sixth tier when you talk to some players. And we say we can't have them play at the same time as the tests are on. Part of the reason why that's the case is because Australian cricket really happens for about 5 or 6 weeks a year. You have a 3 to 4 week shoulder peak season and 3 to 4 weeks either side. So 5 to 6 weeks of shoulder stuff. And then the other competitor on the other side of that is footy. You know what I mean? Footy takes up the conversation all the way through to almost November, and then it'll kick off in February again. So, you know, AFL and rugby league, you know, almost seem to be the other impediment to a cricket season in full shape. If you had a cricket season that was able to run for longer in Australia, you could run a Big Bash and a test series separately, then all players can play, just as it is in England, for example. So how do you strategically manage that? You know, if you accept domestic franchise competitions are important, but that Australia can only fit its cricket into, like, you know, a peak season of 3 to 5 weeks because of footy. What sort of levers is Cricket Australia pulling to try and create more space so that we can do all of these things?
Yeah, and yeah, we have to, you know, be creative around that. I mean, I think for the cricket fans, I mean, you've got that season, but obviously there's tours that, you know, they can watch cricket throughout the year in different places, you know, men and women playing everywhere now. And, you know, you would have seen in the recent announcement that, you know, since I think 1948-49, you know, the women going back to play at the MCG, you know, 75 odd years, that's going to be, you know, a huge event.
That's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
In day 9 as well.
Day 9.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Pink ball. So that's a new addition, you know, to the calendar domestically. That'll be very special. But no, look, I think that we have a position that is reasonable at the moment, but it can be better.
Mm.
And we're looking at the schedule and the timing. We have to seriously think about it. If you look at it, the truncate outside the IPL, most competitions are shorter than the Big Bash. The shorter, you know, does give you a capacity to attract more players, you know, and you're not taking as much schedule and window.
Mm.
So that's something we have to think about. You know, it obviously is a staple for the summer from about mid-December till the end of January. There's regular games, great for broadcasters, great for fans.
Wall to wall.
But there is a balance. you know, and I think we need to kind of think through that. I think there's incredible players that play the Big Bash. I mean, and you see the emergence of talent. I mean, you know, Jake Fraser-McGurk has kind of burst onto the scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Ollie Davies is, you know, they're kind of given.
He's from New South Wales as well, so he's probably next cab off the rank.
Pretty close, I would have thought. Yeah.
I'm not a selector.
Yeah. I
am from New South Wales.
Yeah.
But I was born in Victoria, so like I don't, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I keep.
We got to stick to you.
Quiet. I get that bit quiet. That bit.
Is there a lot of AFL chat at Jollymon as well, by the way? Like you're in Melbourne today. We're obviously from Sydney as well, but like you go into Jollymon, is it just, you know, how about the Cats last week? You know, and how's your AFL chat?
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, I'm a Giants fan.
Okay. Says it all.
Top of the table though.
Yeah. Well, and they look good.
Yeah. Name five players.
I don't know. It could be the year.
Yeah. Alex Carey.
Yeah, that's right. Speaking of like talent in the Big Bash, Mike. Like, I look at the PSL and the Aussie guys that have played in the PSL that have spoken to us. They say it's awesome.
Yeah.
Obviously, cricket back in the region as well. Test matches, which people are really excited about in Pakistan. Obviously, not allowed to play in the IPL for fairly obvious reasons. Indian players not allowed to play outside of India. I just wonder, like, a couple of years ago, actually, there was Rizwan, Babar Azam and Shaheem were all scheduled to play in the Big Bash when they pulled out. I just wonder, like, if there's some sort of allegiance possible to get, like, the Pakistani players coming into the Big Bash. I'm just thinking of ways to bring, like, to strengthen that competition that maybe if the Australian players cannot, because Pakistan, obviously, they came out here and gave us three great test matches really this summer, but fundamentally it doesn't seem viable longer term for Pakistan, unfortunately, to play test cricket. So I'm just wondering, like, and they've got such a white ball team. Is that a way to strengthen the Big Bash? Some sort of allegiance with PSL?
No, all of them. I mean, like, I think we should be thinking creatively with the ECB, you know, with Pakistan, with Bangladesh.
Yeah.
I mean, we should be absolutely looking for partnerships, an opportunity to kind of connect in
and open
those audiences to teams and players through the Big Bash. So yes, and there are discussions, you know,
really? Okay, yeah.
Across all of those.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that I think it creates a much stronger league, you know, if you are connected in, you've got greater player pool, but also broader audiences. You know, that's what you want. I mean, you know, sponsors are going to be interested, the wider the audience
base. Absolutely, yeah.
But it also just generates more followership of the league, and, you know, that's something that we need to do. So strategic partnership should be part of it, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
The 100 has been subject to, you know, to private equity proposals. The MLC in the US has 4 out of the 6 franchises owned by Indian franchises. That's always been discussed in Australia, whether those kinds of franchises will come and knock on the door with the BBL as well. I read last year that you got Morgan Stanley to come and have a look, putting everything on the table in terms of private equity in cricket. What became of that? When everything was on the table, what did you see? What's your position on that entire idea as it relates to cricket in Australia?
Yeah, I think you have to be curious. And if you're not curious, you're not going to grow. You're going to miss opportunities. Mm. And, you know, for us, I mean, what is going on across the world of sport with private equity is fascinating. And it's growing exponentially. So the question is that something we should consider? You start with the why. You know, so why would we need private equity? Mm. You know, there's been examples of financial challenge or distress has kind of brought in capital to kind of bridge a way out of it. You know, we're not in that position. I mean, we're still kind of working through the final elements across cricket of the COVID pain. You know, this is the last kind of period following this tour, as we obviously go into a much stronger position in the next couple of years. So it's not, we don't have a financial imperative, but what we're curious about is, well, what could it bring? And, you know, it's pretty clear. If you look at private equity, they have a laser-like focus, great capability on sort of generating revenue and unearthing opportunities and assets and presentable assets in a whole range of different formats, but particularly digitally, that we need to go up the curve on. So, I mean, certainly there is capability in Cricket Australia, but you know what we saw with the focus, the private equity firms and the partnerships and the skill sets that were applied to it, you know, that's was mainly the main benefit of the private equity partner, and we can do that ourselves. So the decision was, well, we don't need that capital. That gives away flexibility in an already constrained environment. But what we can do is kind of double down in terms of the various approaches we've seen from other sports and private equity to help us grow the game. So
you got them in and they gave you some insights. You went, thanks. We can do that ourselves. It's free discovery.
It was a lot of people involved, lots of consideration, and it was important. It was very instructive. And, you know, you look at the private equity firms, you look at the various sports, and, you know, there's a learning. And, you know, as administrators, you've got to learn from those that are doing things well and greatly. And, you know, what can you import, what you can't. So, you know, it's certainly something you wouldn't, sort of rush into, and you know, not every sport has gone down it. You know, we're certainly not be rushing into anything, but the discipline, the approach, the focus, that's something that we're going gangbusters on.
You mentioned, you mentioned before, would you say the value of the US sports market, $250 billion?
Yeah, that's a conservative
My
number.
God, okay. Wouldn't want a slice of that myself.
Yeah, that's all right. MLC.
Well, you probably will, aren't you? You're going over.
They haven't announced that, but it's all good.
That's not done.
No, that's fine. No, we've done some people.
It's exclusive.
Yeah, that's right.
We're meant to get exclusives from him. God, we're bad at this.
Of things going to make the news, Mike Baird reveals that great cricket is going to be in America. Anyway, you know, like it feels like a cricket inverted commas has had a crack at the US market a couple of times, but now feels like maybe more so than ever. Obviously, cricket's going to be in the Olympics in LA in 2028. Hopefully, it continues in Brisbane in 2032. There was a census in the US in 2020, and of the people that identify as one race, Indians now have past Chinese. There's more Indian people than Chinese people in the US. So there's already this existing market, you would suspect, of cricket-loving fans. You couple that with the IPL owners owning four of the six teams. Do you think that cricket's going to be able to make it in the US? Because it's a competitive market. And also, why do they want that other than just money? Or is it just money?
No, I mean, it's the biggest sports market in the world.
Yeah,
so
okay.
If a sport can survive and thrive there, there's huge opportunities.
No, I
think you're right. I mean, the numbers that I've seen show that it's just under 40 million in terms of those living in the US with a Southeast Asian descent. So that's a strong
a lot of people
basis.
Well, it's more than Australia already.
And so you have that already in place in country. So, you know, I think there's, you know, a very significant chance of success. And what you're talking about with the Olympics, I mean, that's going to elevate it significantly, 28. And then we've obviously got Brisbane, and the expectation is that India will have it in 36. So there's almost 12 years of cricket in the Olympics at a minimum. And so the anchoring that in the US market and where that starts with the World Cup that's going there. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, you know, the NRL, you know, should be commended for being bold and, you know, taking some initiative into that market. But we actually have an underlying opportunity of people who are living in America that love to play cricket, love to watch cricket, want to support cricket. So the very reason they're there, well, we have to maximise, you know, that and grow that, because it's the biggest sports market in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, why would we not want to be there? And it's the fastest growing game in the world. Being in the US, I think it's going to be exciting. And I think the World Cup, together with the great cricketer visitors, is really going to boost it.
It's the biggest sports market and the second biggest sport. It just feels like there's something there for it. But
yes.
Are you going to go to the World Cup?
I'm not sure. Okay. I'd love to. I mean, you know, if I can, I'd love to go on the program. But I'll see. I'd love to go.
Yeah. That India-Pakistan game in New York. I know it's on Long Island, but still, I mean, that could be anything. It could be terrible, but...
Well, no. I grew up in New York, so it's...
Amazing.
Yeah, so I've
got to go back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually went to Yankee Stadium before I went to the SCG.
Yeah,
of
course.
And, you know, now we're talking.
The Yankees, I can name their 1978 World Series.
Good side that year.
Starting yeah, side. It was yeah. a very good side. Are you a Yankees fan?
No, I've been once, so yeah.
Oh, right.
Big fan. Yeah.
I'm a big
yeah.
fan.
Yeah.
But...
It was a big dog knock around for the Yankees yeah. in 1978. Like, it's a name we'd know.
You wouldn't. Reggie Jackson?
Reggie Jackson. Yeah.
He was an absolute legend.
Not to be confused with Shoeless Joe Jackson as well.
No, it wasn't Shoeless Joe. Yeah. Who else is my... Craig Nettles was a favourite.
That sounds like very second grade.
Yeah. No, Craig yeah. Nettles, third baseman. Bucky yeah. Dent.
Bucky Dent.
Chris Rogers.
Bucky Dent, he, in a tiebreaker game with the Red Sox, he hit yeah. hardly hit home runs and hit a home run...
Oh, nice.
Over the Green Monster yeah. in Boston.
Oh.
And that's so he's Fenway, Bucky yeah. Dennis forever in my mouth. I watched it live. You know,
that's awesome.
I just was exciting. Anyway, it was and Louisiana Lightning went Ron Guidry went 25-3
okay.
that season. And that's in terms of pitching terms, that's about as dominant as you can.
Okay, right.
So anyway, long story, that there is a great pulse to New York in sport. It is the most incredible city.
Oh, yeah, it is, yeah.
So to see, you know, my favourite sport, you know, come to my favourite city outside of Australia is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And the India, they're talking about that India-Pakistan game being the most watched sporting event of all time.
Really?
Mm.
You still follow still follow the baseball?
Ex-Olympics.
Oh, okay. Do you still follow baseball?
Yes.
You should talk to Ian Chappell. Once saw Ian Chappell checking the box scores of the MLB as an Australian player brought up his 100 once.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ian Chappell.
Watching the Orioles.
Yeah.
There's a I don't know whether I should tell this about Ian Chappell. I might tell it very quickly because he might
like. Because he was a former baseballer.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, no. He so he went down to my local club. So, and I didn't mention them in club cricket. So I played for the Harbord Hogs.
Uh-huh.
Well, when they're...
Oh, sorry for only mentioning Camaray. It sounds like you've been to a couple of
clubs. Well, no, the Harbord Hogs, which is the Harbord Bowling Club Cricket Club.
Right.
Harbord Bowling Cricket Club. And, yeah, when they're desperate, I played games. And so this year I played one. None for 23, I think, off my over. And
can I check that on PlayHQ or seven,
I think, was what I got.
One for 23 off one over.
No, none for 23.
One over, okay. Yeah.
So, but I feel part of the team.
For sure.
Because they just won the premiership. They just won the premiership.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But no,
congrats.
Yeah.
To the Hogs. Yeah, I'm glad the Hogs are on this.
Yeah.
But then last season, Ian Chappell came at the presentation night. And he's giving his usual talk. And he's, look, how do you put it? He's not flattering of cricket administrators and the board of cricket Australia more generally. Yeah. And he...
Chappelli.
Yeah, well, and he picked me out. He said, oh, you know, Mike Baird, look, he may well have been a great premier. I don't know. He may well have been a great sort of banker. I don't know. But he doesn't know anything about cricket. And the Hogs were up and about. So they said, hang on, that's Beardy.
Oh, the Hogs.
No,
I was hoping they were backing him up. Yeah, no, that's true.
Oh, he's terrible.
Yeah,
that's right. Oh, no.
He's up for 23.
Pitch it up.
No, the season before I got a 19.
Yeah.
You know, so okay. Maybe. But no, it was, so that's Chappelli. He was quite surprised, I think, to find some support for an administrator.
Yeah.
Harsh segue from the US to Afghanistan. Not unrelated, but the Cricket Australia recently cancelled a men's tour to Afghanistan. That was in the FTP, and it has aroused a fair amount of negative sentiment from different sections of the community. And I've seen it globally as well. But like, I mean, why did Cricket Australia do that? What's your position on it? Especially. I think there are a lot of people out there who regard it as sort of morbidly cynical, given that it can appear at face value to be a convenient cancellation, particularly in a scenario where the Australian team does play against Afghanistan in ICC tournaments. I appreciate there are some fairly reasonable arguments for that, but I figured it would be good to ask you.
Yeah, no, sure. Look, you know, it's... It's not an easy one, and it's a wrestle. You know, this has been wrestled with, kind of at the board, and you know, there's a general sentiment that, which I agree with, impossible, but agree with, and you know, trying to keep politics out of sport, you know, as much as you possibly can. There are individuals, there are connected causes, almost impossible to do.
Mm.
But I get that, you know, that's what a lot of people think. In relation to this, though, the implications and the circumstances we've seen and heard about women in Afghanistan, it seems a very difficult thing to walk away from. So, you know, in a game that promotes inclusivity and has got a strategic priority of trying to grow the women's game, support the women's game, well, this is a real clang. And, you know, I don't know whether other boards have wrestled with it as much as we have, but, you know, we've made a determination it's not something that we want to walk away from. You know, there's standards and values that, you know, at some point you come to a line. Now, you know, are we perfect? No. Are the things that we've done wrong? Absolutely. But is this something that we collectively think that we should be taking a stand on? And the answer has been yes. Now, you know, we've obviously liaised with government on that. I mean, you know, they've got sort of strong views. But it also is dynamic, you know. So from my point of view, what we're looking for is actually action that women are going to be allowed to play sport again, you know, to participate in cricket again. And, you know, that's what I've said to my counterpart in Afghanistan. We just need to see that there's progress. And if there is some progress, well, you know, let's reconvene in terms of the tour. So, yeah, that's the position we've taken. You know, there's wide and varied views on it, but I think it's the right decision. And, you know, I also want to be able to try and influence, you know, with my counterpart in Afghanistan to say, well, you know, please show us, you know, opportunities or the emergence and small developments even that we're actually starting to see progress with women being able to play sport there.
How far in advance do we, inverted commas, book these tours? Like, so how long ago was this tour planned
the first time? Well, yeah, before it was deferred, I think it's about 3 years. You know, so it's a long time.
Yeah,
In the making.
Yeah, so I guess, like, to be honest, I don't even know where I sit with it, Mike, myself, you know. Yeah. Like, we did a charity event for the LBW Trust last year in Sydney. Justin Lang was there as well, and the special guests were these two Afghani...
Banafsher and Nilab.
That's right. Yeah. Sorry, were you going to ask the question? Have you got
No. I just remember the names.
They're amazing. They're
fantastic.
Yeah.
The story is a combination of incredible, abhorrent, you know, all of it. It's amazing and scary and all of it. So I can't reconcile a thing in my head of like, oh no, we should be going to play there, as much as you want to grow the game and all those things. So like then it becomes, I'm thinking about this out loud with you, I think.
Yeah.
But so then should we have played them in the World Cup? You know, but that's different because the ICC have organized that. It's, there's clearly a difference between that and choosing to go there.
In the bilateral.
Yeah. You know, and also Maxi batted really well. You know, he's got a double 100.
Well, I think that's the best innings I've ever
seen. without question.
In any format.
Without question. So I guess what I'm asking there is, like, why organise a tour in the first place? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean that...
Because you mentioned other boards haven't wrestled with it either. It just looks like they haven't organised anything.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it have been better not
to organise? England ever gone there? I can't think they have.
No, but look, I think there's... I'm not going to speak for the ECB, but
right.
You know, I would say there's sympathy for our position.
Right.
Would be my standing. But, I mean, if it was, and I don't know the date, you know, on when it was actually put in the calendar, but my expectation was it may well have been before.
Before events. The Taliban came back in. Yeah, right. Okay.
But regardless, I'm pretty sure it was.
Yeah, okay.
So that would be the
reason. I understand. Yeah, reason. Okay. I reckon it makes sense. Yeah.
But also, look, it's I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the fact that we're playing in ICC events, well, not organised by us. Like, I understand people finding where you're trying to be too nuanced about it.
Yeah.
But I guess that, you know, I would say you manage what you're going to manage, and certainly bilateral is totally within sort of our control.
Right, yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, so that's where we've taken a stand. And, you know, I will be engaging with the chair of Afghanistan every meeting, and we'll be talking about it. So I'll be asking for the progress. And, you know, the tour and the opportunity to tour and play, you know, my hope that is taken. Well, we really want to do that. So, you know, what can we do? You know, what's possible in the women's game? But, you know, it's also difficult for them. You know, there's things that are in their control and things that aren't. But I certainly think it's the right thing to do.
Mm. Yeah.
Last one from me. This is a headline that came through in the summer, Mike, and I know I'm harking back to something we talked about earlier, but just finishing on this note. It just says, Baird, rich nations must share wealth to keep test cricket healthy. are you laughing cynically at that? Like, novel idea. I, in my life, would love to see that. I can wake up in the morning. I would love to see people share money to that effect.
Yeah.
I've studied at university and understand the realities of, you know, neo-capitalism as well. It flies, the idea of sharing wealth flies in the face of free market enterprise a lot of the time. Is there a scenario where rich nations will share appropriate amounts of wealth to keep test cricket healthy? And are you behind that? What's your position on that headline? I could have started the interview with that, but I'll just keep it to the end. Yeah.
No, the position is consistent. Like, I think we have to pull every lever possible to maintain the history, the legacy and the primacy of test cricket. You can't ignore the commercial realities, and that's where I said at the beginning, you can do both. Undoubtedly, part of the challenge for some countries is that, you know, they receive almost nothing for test cricket, you know, whereas the white ball disparity is huge. Mm. You know, so trying to narrow that gap. I mean, that's a simple principle, try and narrow that gap. Now, are countries prepared to put into that? Well, I think they should be. And, you know, from our point of view, if I went across the Australian cricket system and said, look, do you think that we want to keep test cricket as strong as possible and a key feature of the game, I think it would be not unanimous, but it'd be a very, very strong position. So that strong position is something as administrators we have to play. And, you know, sometimes that comes with a cost. Now, you know, you don't want to be in a position that you're holding something that's unsustainable. It is sustainable for particularly three countries. But we've got to ask ourselves, well, to maintain that, the more nations that are playing competitive test cricket, the better they are, you know, at our contest. The next two summers, part of it's built up because of, you know, the West Indies of the Gabba. I mean, that was spectacular what we saw from them. And Pakistan, every match was competitive. I mean, they were almost in a position they could have won every match at some point.
Yeah.
That sort of building the contest towards the ultimate test match against in the next two summers, I think is essential. So, yes, you need to make windows available. You need to make, I think, funding available. And, you know, that should be in the onus of those countries that have the most resources.
Well, we've probably been greedy with your time, Mike. Thanks so much for giving us your time. Thanks so much for coming into the studio. It's a privilege for us to be able to sit with someone of your level of influence. So very much appreciate it. All the best for the rest of your time in Melbourne. Some AFL chat. And hopefully we catch you in New York
for
more of a baseball education.
Sounds like a date. No, thank you. It's a privilege to be on the program. Congrats. Like, what you guys have done for the game can't be underestimated. It's huge. So thank you for your passion for the game. Thank you for taking us to a whole different market. Look forward to seeing you in New York.
Well, don't forget the power of club cricket. You know, look how far it can go.
Totally can.
Mm. And we won't be sharing any profits.
Just to be clear.